Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org. Hello and welcome to Nature Now. This is your host, Nan Evans. And today we're going to take kind of a different look at a subject that's near and dear to my heart, and that's life in the intertidal. Now, we've had tide pulling and tide short programs before, but this one's really special. This is exploring the intertidal at night. What do you see that's different? What do you see that's the same? Well, and actually, even how do you do it? Because it is night, and that does make things a little different. So we're going to be talking to Carolyn Woods from the Port Townsend Marine Science Center in just a minute. So I do want to do a little shout out to the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Even though the aquarium is closed due to condition of the pier, they have opened a facility downtown on Water Street, and their museum is still open on the dry side of Fort Worden. Check out their programs and offerings at, it's very simple, ptmsc.org. So now let's talk to Carolyn Woods. Carolyn is the education manager at Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and you've been there quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, I started out in 2014 as a summer intern working with the Marine Mammal Stranding Network in summer camps.
I do remember that, yes. And you've done lots of things during your, that's what, 12 years?
Yeah, just about, not continuously, but I also did a term as an AmeriCorps member in that stretch, working in the museum in particular, and I've been the full-time education person since the end of 2016.
And the education program is both kids and adults, is that right?
Yeah, I focus primarily on the K-12 mm-hmm. programs, so school programs and then our summer camps.
Well, we're going to be hearing much more about some of those education activities in a little bit, but let's talk about tide pulling. And this is sort of the end of winter. You've had a season of nighttime tide pulling outings.
That's right.
And we're going into a season of springtime and summer daytime mm-hmm. tide pooling. So the first and kind of obvious question is, why is it that the wonderful low tides we have during the winter are around midnight or, or 9 o'clock at night? Anyway, they're in the night, whereas those same wonderful low tides in the summer are in the daytime, and we can, wander out at our leisure and have a wonderful sunny mm-hmm. day on the beach. And I was thinking about that lately, too, as I was driving downtown and seeing how high some of the tides are right now. They're just super high tides, it seems. Tell us a bit about why that's the case.
Yeah, I love that you started with the hardest question, because to answer this, you have to get into orbital mechanics, astrophysics.
Well, don't go quite that far.
Okay. I mean, the really basic answer is it depends on the sun and the moon and how they are working together. About every month, we have what are called spring tides. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to do with the season. The spring tides are when the sun and the moon are lined up. And again, that's about every month. The summer and the winter lows are influenced by Earth's axial tilt and the angle that the sun is basically pulling the water. So in the summer, that happens in the daytime because we're pointed towards the sun more in the daylight. And so we get our really low lows in the early morning through afternoon. And then in the winter, it's the opposite, where the Earth, the northern hemisphere anyway, is pointed away from the sun. And so the sun is pulling on our water more when it's dark out. Also, it just is dark more often here in the winter, so you're more likely to have the lows happen at night.
Well, I think that's a good basic explanation. And when I think about, you use the phrase spring tides, which mm-hmm. is not about the season, but I think of it, and it's a little simplistic, because I know there are many, many factors that determine our tide cycles, but it's when the Earth, the moon, and the sun are kind of lined up.
Yeah,
so
lined
that
up
their poles
mm-hmm.
magnify each other.
Yes.
I don't know why it got named Springtide.
I don't know the etymology of that either. Yeah.
And I do know that predicting tides is a science unto itself because of all the factors. But then we're thinking of the fact that, of course, the Earth is on an axis. It's not sort of straight up and down relative to
anything.
Yeah, it's tilted. It's tilted, yeah. And tilted, you know, I used to be able to come up with the number of degrees, but it's
about
37 or something.
I think it's a little bit less than that, but yeah, it's noticeable.
Yeah. And so just to make sure I've got it, I'm going to reiterate that when the tilt is toward the sun,
uh-huh.
the northern hemisphere is facing the sun, and that's when you get summertime and the lower tides in the daytime.
Yeah.
And then when it's facing away, the northern hemisphere is lined up away from the sun. That's when you get them in the night.
Yeah. This is a hard thing to explain on the radio.
Right,
if you were here with us, we're moving our hands so much.
My hands.
Yeah. My best advice is look up a diagram online. There are so many good resources for that.
And which also reminds me, many years ago, I did a series of interviews with an author named Jonathan White on the tides. I don't know if you've seen his books.
I don't know if I have.
But it's a really interesting book with stories about tides that vary from his personal stories as a mariner and getting stranded once or twice to cultural stories about how early peoples thought about tides, to what causes the tides, to, you know, tides in different parts of the world. I found it really fascinating. Name again is Jonathan White on tides. Okay, so though we've got that general piece set there. Thinking about tides, whether it's daytime or night, if we're out on the beaches, particularly on the rocky shores, you can see that there are bands where certain animals and plants live, and they're very obvious. I mean, particularly at the low tide, you can see those bands and zones. So talk a bit about why that is the case.
Yeah, what you're talking about is intertidal zonation,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lot of factors that contribute to that, but two main things, hydration and predation. So talking about hydration, it's how well is this living thing adapted to being out of the water and exposed to the sun and the wind and the elements.
And I think of a barnacle when you say that, you know.
Exactly right.
Barnacles can just shut down from the outside. And
something with a hard shell that it can close completely and conserve the water in its body. So things like barnacles or limpets or mussels, you tend to see higher up in the intertidal zone. They'll also extend their reach up into the splash zone to avoid predators. So predators are also controlling what is found in different intertidal zones, like the ochre star. Our purple sea stars here are voracious predators of the mussels. And so you'll often see a band of mussels around a rock just above the reach of where a sea star can go because they don't have a hard shell to enclose their bodies. So they can't stay out of the water quite as long as a mussel can.
And your conversation about the sea stars and mussels, that was one of the keystone study.
That's right.
Done by a professor at UW, Robert Payne, some years ago, where he actually showed really for the first time how important predation by the sea stars was on the zonation, where other animals could live in those mussel zones. Well, and then I guess it goes to the obvious, the creatures that are very exposed and fragile, like the nudibranchs.
Yeah, the soft, squishy things.
They're going to be lower and live in a lower area.
Yeah, where they're spending less time exposed, and maybe they only get exposed a few times a month at the lowest low tides.
And I would imagine, particularly in the summertime, exposure to the sun and heat is going to make a difference, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw that a couple years ago when we had that really intense heat dome.
Right.
And it happened during the summer when, unfortunately, we do have those really extreme lows during the daytime. So that was kind of a 1-2 punch for a lot of things and took out a lot of shellfish and other things.
Yeah, I remember that year. That was very sad.
Yeah.
Give me some more examples about things you can see at low tide and why it's really, really worth getting out there at low tide.
Yeah, I mean, this is your chance to see things that are normally covered up by the water and hiding. Unless you're a scuba diver, you're probably never going to see a sea cucumber, for example.
Right.
But when the tide is really low, you can head out to the rocky areas and see where they've tucked themselves under crevices and under, like, the blankets of seaweed mm-hmm. that you can move. It's your chance to see sea slugs or nudibranchs, like you mentioned earlier. And if you're extremely lucky, you might see something as exciting as a giant Pacific octopus.
Oh, yes.
That's happened a couple times. Mm-hmm. Most often the sighting is, oh, I think I saw a tentacle. That's right, it whips away under the rocks. And you're like, well, I guess that was an octopus. And that's one of the benefits of going out at night, too, is the giant Pacific octopus is nocturnal. So you're more likely
to see it out hunting.
Mm-hmm.
At night and low tide, you can have less pressure on them in terms of water evaporation. What are you likely to see at night, in addition to the giant Pacific octopus, that one would rarely see in the daytime?
Well, a lot of our animals are feeding nocturnally or more active when it's dark. So things like some of the fish and sculpins. Last year, we saw two grunt sculpins in a tide pool at low tide.
Really?
Yeah. I had never seen one tide pooling before, so that was a really exciting highlight for me. Some things like our arthropods, our crustaceans, crabs, and shrimps will be more active at night. Some of them are drawn to light.
Because I think, you know, oftentimes you do see crabs in the daytime, but they're sort of huddled in, even though they do have a hard shell. But
there's still predators out there for them. We actually had an exciting sighting in January. I did not realize great blue herons would hunt at night, but as we were tide pooling and heading out to the edge of the water, there was a great blue heron that was feeding in the dark.
Boy, I didn't know they did that either.
We were all surprised. Yeah. So you're not necessarily safe from predators at night.
Yeah, I think of them primarily as predators on fish.
Mm-hmm. They will eat any small crawling thing they can get in their mouth. So absolutely, like, crabs and shrimps are included too.
That's interesting. So let's think more about the nighttime. It must present some challenges to actually getting out and seeing things. So what do you have to be prepared for if you're going tide pooling at night?
Yeah, the first thing is to choose your location. Make sure it's somewhere you're allowed to access at night. We are fortunate that Jefferson County Parks is willing to give the Marine Science Center permission to be in the parks after hours.
You know, that's really important because in theory, come dusk, places like North Beach Park,
most parks are closed.
So you actually get special permission to.
We notify them so mm-hmm. that they also notify the Port Townsend Police Department and everyone knows we're okay to be there. Yeah. We're not causing a ruckus. Mm-hmm. My other recommendation is you can actually walk the length of downtown Port Townsend on a really good low tide, like a -2 foot or lower tide. You can walk from almost the ferry terminal to the Maritime Center and check out all the things living on the pilings.
Underneath. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I'm also imagining a headlamp or a...
Yeah, you're going to need a light to be able to see. And you're going to want the normal things you would have to prepare to tide pool safely. So you want some waterproof shoes with good traction. I usually wear rain boots, but you could wear a hiking boot or something like that. And whatever clothes you need to be prepared for the mm-hmm. weather, especially at night in the winter. Yes, you're going to need layers. You're going to want gloves, a hat, a coat, and a buddy, of course. You shouldn't go tide mm-hmm. pooling at night alone. We always make sure people go out in groups so that no one gets lost.
Right. Especially easy to do in the night. I always take a hiking stick with me, not only to sort of steady myself on a slippery rock, but I can reach into a tide pool and just kind of poke the seaweed aside
mm-hmm.
and see what's underneath there.
Yeah, if you need that extra traction, that's a great thing to do to help with balance on the slippery rocks, too. I just like to check people's poles when we go out in a group and make sure the end is soft and rubbery and not pointy and
pointy.
Pokey.
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, that's a really good point. Oh, pun not intended. And you can buy those little rubber tips that go on. You know, any hiker would know that. So what about, I've seen kind of flurry in the last couple of years about UV lights mm-hmm. for nighttime. Why would one take a UV light and what could you see?
So the reason to bring your own light, either a UV light or a special blue wavelength light, is that a lot of living things in the intertidal zone and just generally have this property called biofluorescence. And if you've never heard of that, it's kind of similar to bioluminescence, but the difference is that with bioluminescence, that's a living thing that's producing its own light, so you can see it with
like
the naked eye.
You can see it if a boat goes through the water or you're... usually single-celled algae that are doing, and they're producing their own light.
Yes. Biofluorescence is when a living thing is absorbing the light and a property in their body is changing the wavelength of that light, and so it bounces back out as a different color, and often it's more intense. A fluorescence is, you know, fluorescent neon colors. Mm-hmm. So they're really pretty and exciting to see.
So it's the same trick that a lot of geologists use.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the rocks are not producing the light, but they're reflecting and changing the wavelengths, and you get different colors.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of substances can fluoresce, and mm-hmm. it's biofluorescing when it's a living thing that's doing it.
Right. So another thing to think about, I think probably especially at night, but all the time, is doing this safely. Safely for oneself and the people one is with, and safely for the environment. So what are your guidelines for tide pooling, whether it's at night or in the daytime?
Yeah, it's important to keep in mind low tide is a stressful time for things living in the ocean. A lot of them are really well adapted to being out of the water, but it's challenging for them. And so we want to make sure we're minimizing our impact during this sensitive, challenging time mm-hmm. for living things where they're out of the water. The basics for human safety is, number one, you want to make sure you have the right gear, like we talked about mm-hmm. earlier. And you want to move slow in the tide pools. Mm-hmm. Most of the cool stuff you can see is not going to go anywhere fast. So stay low, bend your knees if you can, and move slowly so that
you can look a lot.
Yeah, you're going to have to do some, I like to call it tide pooling yoga, where you sort of bend down and get at an awkward angle to look underneath rocks. Mm-hmm. The things we do also to keep the living things safe are, one, tell people how to touch gently. We like to use two peaceful fingers.
Not poking fingers, but two peaceful fingers.
So you're not going to pull anything off of a rock mm-hmm. that it's clinging onto for safety while it waits for the tide to come back. And we're touching gently, ideally with wet hands, so mm-hmm. we don't dry anything out. And there's some things that we just try to avoid touching in the tide pools at all because they're more sensitive.
For example,
that would be fish. They've got like a slime mucus coating all over their bodies. That's helped keeping them hydrated, and it's part of their immune system. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to rub that off. So we like to leave fish alone. And we also avoid touching really soft, squishy, delicate things like the sea slugs. And in the middle of the anemones, right where they've got their tentacles, and then in the center, that's their mouth.
Yeah.
They also only have one opening for their digestive tract, so what goes in comes out
the
that
same
end.
Yes.
So don't put your fingers there, right? And then for your safety, I recommend people don't touch large crabs unless...
Oh, yes.
Right, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. And talk to me a bit about, well, I guess maybe it's etiquette. If one wants to look under a rock, because there are some really cool things that mm-hmm. you won't see unless you sometimes even have to pull it up a bit, the rock up a bit, and look underneath. What's the etiquette around rocks?
We do try to avoid moving rocks at all. Mm-hmm. It can be so damaging and disturbing to the habitats. There'll be animals that have burrowed under the rock in the soft sediment. And a lot of the living things on the rock, they want to be in exactly the position they're in. So if they're on the top,
so any disturbance is a problem.
Yeah, instead of moving rocks, what I really like to do is find a big rock that's got maybe some seaweed draped over the edges or a seaweed covering a tide pool. And you can gently move and lift that like seaweed curtain or blanket mm-hmm. and see a lot of the stuff that is trying to hide and find like a darker wet spot without, again, damaging mm-hmm. like burrows or changing the position of an animal or potentially even crushing something under the rock.
Yeah, actually, that's good caution. I remember back in the early days of my tide pooling, it was okay to turn those rocks over as long as you turned them back very gently, left them in the same place. Mm-hmm. Mostly if you were a critter that didn't tolerate the dryness, you wanted to be under the rock. But I like the updating sensitivity of it's better not even to do that.
Yeah, if you
just put your nose under there if you can move the seaweed around.
That's right.
Something.
If you really want to minimize your impact, that's the best way to go. I also was taught as a child that, yeah, as long as you put the rock back, mm-hmm. it's okay to flip it. But it does have an impact. And if we want to minimize our impact as visitors in this really exciting habitat where living things have to deal with so many challenges with the water coming in and out, it's best not to disturb that. Yeah.
So it is an exciting place. I love it. It's to me, it's better than Christmas, just sort of poking around to see what I can see. You've mentioned a couple of fun things you've seen. The giant Pacific octopus at night, the feeding blue heron at night. Do you have another sort of just kind of favorite, or maybe more than one, experience?
Yeah, one highlight of doing two winter low tide walks this month was we got to visit this particular large glacial erratic boulder that's on the beach.
That's at North Beach.
Yes, area. At North yeah. Beach. And both times we went there, we saw this very large purple sea star just about in the exact same spot both times. So it was fun to see what I think is probably the same animal two times in a row.
And to me, it's really special to see the purple ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sea stars have had a challenging yeah. time over the past decade mm-hmm. with the sea star yeah. wasting outbreak. So anytime we see a large sea star, an ochre star, that species was hit really hard. Sunflower sea mm-hmm. stars as well. So getting to see those.
So have you seen many sunflower stars recently?
Just a few. We saw one near our pier on the piling, and I'm mentioning the location because this was about a year ago, but we're trying not to send people out to where those specific animals mm-hmm. are because they still need protection.
Because it was so stunning to see those beautiful sun stars just disappear or dissolve into goo.
It was pretty devastating to see that happening in the environment. Unfortunately, we're not seeing as much wasting these days. So we're not seeing as many sick sea stars that are falling apart. And we're starting to see some more individuals and juveniles that seem to be a recovering population, but it's probably going to take
terrific.
A lot more time.
So let's look forward for a minute. This is early spring when we're having this conversation. Your nighttime sessions are now over. You had the last of them
in February.
And the Science Center will start up the spring and summer season when about?
We usually kick those off around mid-May and go through the end of summer, so the end of August. And we'll have dates posted on our website so that people can register in advance. Most of our good summer lows are happening in the early to mid-morning to the afternoon. And we schedule a lot of our programs on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who's interested, the clue is keep watch on your website.
Yeah, those dates should be on our website already.
Well, terrific. And you do want folks to register. That's just so that you know who's coming because they're free, aren't they?
The summer low tide walk programs, we do charge an admission for that. So I recommend registering in advance.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And that money helps support just our programs overall, mm-hmm. our staff time. We're a nonprofit, so we appreciate all the community support that we get.
So there is a way for a listener to really participate in these things. I didn't realize you charged for the summer, but I'm sure it's an extraordinarily reasonable price, whatever it is.
Yeah. And there's a discount if you are a member of the
Marine
Science Center.
Well, there you go. Yes. And I will recommend that. I've been a member before we actually even moved here. So
well, thank you for your support.
Any sort of final thoughts before we leave the subject of tide pooling?
First, thanks for inviting me on to talk about something that I love doing. I love getting to talk about tide pooling. And if you've never done it before, I highly encourage you to do it. Almost every program that we run, I hear from participants that like, wow, I didn't know all this stuff was out here. Even from people who might have lived in the area for a long time, they'd just never gotten out onto the beach at low tide. And so it's always a delight to get to show people that. And I think they really enjoy it too.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as it's better than Christmas.
Just, and sometimes you can do a low tide walk at night on Christmas.
Yeah, ooh, yeah. Because it's the discovery to me that's like, wow, look what's out here. Look what I can mm-hmm. see, whether it's daytime or not.
Yeah.
So, Carolyn, thank you so much. It's fun now to sort of think about, you know, the seasons are changing and it's time to get out again.
Right. Enjoy that daylight. Enjoy tide pooling when you can see everything around right. you.
And then think about next winter when you can experience the night,
mm-hmm.
which is another really special time. So again, thanks so much. We'll see you tide pooling one of these days, I'm sure.
Sounds good. Thank you, Nan.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed our nighttime exploration of the intertidal area. Again, go to the Port Townsend's Marine Science Center website for more information and about a schedule of upcoming daytime walks in the intertidal. Our engineer today, Nora Petridge, so glad you can join us. If you missed the program or want to hear it again, you can hear it not only on the KPTZ website, just follow the links to their podcast page and then to Nature Now, or on your favorite podcast app. And we also have an Instagram page where you can see pictures of things that we've been talking about. Well, thanks again, Carolyn, and thank everybody for listening. Hope to see you again soon. As we go out, we'll listen to the songs of some nighttime birds.